All right. So, thanks everyone for staying engaged in a good conversation this morning. Very appreciative of the engagement and the level of thought going into the questions for it. So thank you. Moving on into the next portion of our agenda, which is to understand the bill impact tool and some of its considerations for it. So we're going to spend about 45 minutes on this understanding and working through those elements. And let's jump straight into it then.
Thanks, Jordan. Let's move to the next. I think there's a good couple of just placeholder slides here.
Maybe just one other housekeeping item, Spencer, apologies. Thank you everyone for the questions that are still in the open Q&A. I think what we're going to do right now is just make sure that we don't lose sight of them and record them, but we'll probably clear them because I think they're more related to the opening entry. If for some reason we come full circle, please feel free to throw them back in there, but we'll probably move those just to the dismiss bucket for the time being. But please know that they won't be lost along the way. We're definitely still seeing those and keeping record of them.
Yeah, that's an important point. So slide 49. I'm going to talk through the bill impact. We've looked at this a number of different ways, so we're providing a summary of it here. And we also will, at the end, address kind of the bill impact tool that's also available, so you can get the information that's relevant to you. Thank you. Slide 50. Overall, we're looking at a change in the transmission cost recovery of less than 3%. So that's contemplating, you know, some customers paying more, some customers paying less. That total is about 3%. That works out to about between 30 and 50 million, depending on the year. And that is based on a number of assumptions and whatnot that we'll get into in a little bit more detail. The expected increases on a total bill basis would not be more than 15% for any customer. And that's importantly before we get into any mitigation or any treatment like that for, you know, that we'll talk about a little bit this afternoon. But we've looked at this on a total bill basis as well as on a transmission cost basis. And that would be on the transmission cost basis, just looking at the, you know, bulk and regional charges, pod charges, other tariff type charges. We would see potentially increases of up to 50% in transmission costs. And that is where that 15% is coming from. To, you know, address this and deal with those impacts, we're exploring options to mitigate those impacts and provide that kind of transitionary period for customers to adjust over time. And we're looking at that on a transmission cost basis and not a total bill basis. So I think it's really important just to set that up front. We're going to spend a little bit of time talking about the impact before we get into kind of the steps we're taking to address that. Excuse me. The flip side of this is that, you know, a number of customers can expect to see a reduction in transmission costs relative to their bills today. And a lot of that will depend on, you know, how customers are paying for those transmission costs, whether it's directly through the, you know, through the ISO or through their distribution company, or whether it's a rate that's passed on through the distribution charge on your bill. On slide 51, we get into some of the assumptions. And I think the most important thing on this slide is that these are estimates of bill impacts that are based on actual consumption in 2019, which we are using as our test year. And we've applied the current allocation of costs as well as the preferred rate design allocation of costs to the same billing determinants for 2019 so that we can test the change in bills that's, you know, associated just with those changes. So we're not modeling any response. We're not including, you know, how customers would change potentially going forward. We're really just trying to dig into the actual change in transmission charges and how that would play out. So just want to be really clear up front. That's our starting assumption. And that's something that, you know, if you have thoughts about how we can improve that or make it more appropriate, you know, we want to welcome that feedback as well. As I said before, we've calculated this on two bases. One is just the transmission portion of the bill. So that's, you know, the bulk and regional, the pod charges, operating charges, all those transmission tariff charges. And then we've also calculated the total bill impact, which is, you know, all of that plus the energy cost as well, because, you know, both of those really matter in terms of understanding the resulting impact at the end of the day. And we've done this on a pod level basis. So we've done the calculation for each point of delivery. And right now we're presenting this on the 2019 test year basis. So presenting the information related to 2019. We've also gone into a little bit more detail that we're not presenting today, because, you know, we have to pick and choose what it is that is really relevant here. We've calculated this for 2017, 2018, 2019, and 2020. And none of the results really stand out necessarily in terms of being different from one another. Obviously, there's variation from year to year. And a lot of that, you know, just averages out. So that's why we're choosing 2019 as the basis for this presentation. The other important assumption is that we haven't included any long-term retroactive averages for the 12 CPE billing determinant. So, you know, we talked a little bit this morning about how that phased-in approach to implementing that five-year average on the 12 CPE billing determinant would sort of take place, to increase over time. And so when we thought about modeling the bill impact, you know, we didn't think it was appropriate to look backwards in time, because, you know, obviously these rates haven't been in place. So we don't think it's necessarily appropriate to assume that the behavior 5 years ago would be representative of what occurs today or going forward. And so we've used, you know, as a starting point, the 12 CPE as it occurs in that month, just as an assumption that again, you know, I'm trying to be transparent about how we calculated these things, and if there's a preferred alternative or something that you think is more representative, definitely welcome that as well. Obviously, the last point here is just that, you know, actual bills are going to vary from these impacts that we're calculating based on, you know, actual consumption and actual rates. So this is trying to get a better understanding of the impact from the proposed rate design and not necessarily calculating your actual rate to the decimal place. I think that's enough of an overview, and let's get to the goods. So on slide 52, this is on a transmission cost basis. So looking just at that transmission portion of the bill, the percent impacts by range. So along the bottom, we have the different ranges of impacts. There's that 10% category. And then we've just counted the number of substations that fall within each of those buckets and divided that between, you know, the industrial and distribution customers, where industrial is both ISO and DFO transmission connected customers. And just walking through, you know, the furthest left-hand category is that range of -30 to -20% on a transmission cost impact basis. And that's again for 2019 data. And then stepping forward, we get to, you know, the 20 to 10 and 0 to 10 in terms of bill reduction impacts. And then to the right of that line is where we see a positive impact. So the 0 to 10% transmission cost impact, you know, there's 117 industrial customers and 98 distribution DFO pods. And then moving forward, we see that drops off significantly, and we get, you know, in the 10 to 20% range. We have two industrial and two distribution customers. In the 20 to 30% range, it's two and then three. And then lastly, there's one industrial customer in the 30 to 40% range and two industrial customers in that 40 to 50% range. This is all, again, 2019 test year information. And we're really recognizing that the number of customers to the right above that 10% impact threshold are, you know, important to include in our steps moving forward in terms of mitigation. And we think it's a relatively manageable number to be able to engage in a more targeted discussions about how we're managing that transmission cost impact. So we have reached out to all of these customers, all the industrial customers, and we're continuing conversations with the distribution DFOs. It works a little bit differently when you have multiple customers connected to a single pod in terms of how those rates are going to flow through. So we're continuing to have those conversations, but that's, something we'll get into a little bit further on as well. And so we just want to make sure that it's clear to everyone that this is the range of impacts across the spectrum. For the most part, we think this is, going to help us meet that objective of achieving minimal disruption if we're including the additional steps we're taking around mitigation for those parties that are above that 10% transmission cost impact threshold. Slide 53 shows a similar breakdown, but this is on the total bill basis. So same data and same kind of breakdown, but now we're looking at the energy as well as the transmission cost. So this is, historically been part of our assessment in terms of understanding the customers that fall within each of those bill impact ranges. On the left, we have the number of substations, and we have the range of impact along the bottom, broken out by industrial and distribution customers. And then to the left of that line, we have the left of the vertical blue line, just to be clear, we have that customers whose bills will decrease if the, assuming the consumption stays the same and just applying the rates to the 2019 billing determinants, there's a range there from minus 30 to minus 20%, but five customers moving up to, the minus 20 to minus 10%, 32 customers, and then the bulk, almost 300 fall below that or in that minus 10 to 0% category on the total bill percentage change basis. And then looking on the positive side or on the increase in total bill by percentage, we see, there's 126 industrial customers in that category and 98 distribution customers in that 0 to 10% total bill percent increase. And then there are three industrial customers with the impact that ranges between or that falls in that category of 10 to 20% that corresponds to no customer will see an increase of 15% or more on a total bill basis for this 2019 test year data. And that just gives you a sense of, kind of how many customers fall into which category in terms of bill impact. Slide 54 gets into a little bit more of the details. There was a typo in the version that we posted, so that's been corrected here just in the middle column. That's the reason for the red font, but hopefully that didn't trip anyone up. This is some information that we have presented in previous applications, so it might be a little bit familiar on that basis, but I'll walk you through it just so we all have a common understanding of what's going on. So on the left, we have our measure of billing capacity, and that's corresponding to the sizes of different pods. And then across the top, we have our load factor, by those billing capacity categories. And so we're looking at the average transmission cost impact by load factor, and then for customers that fall within each of those different size, billing capacity categories. So that's the percentages that you see in each of the cells. So if we look at, the 0 to 20%, low load factor customers across all sizes, the average transmission cost impact is a reduction. And that's, again, for that 2019 test year. This doesn't change when we look at, when we add more data. And then moving across, we're getting into that 20 to 40% load factor. And again, across all the billing, all the customer sizes, billing measure, as measured by billing capacity, that's works out to an average decrease in transmission costs. And moving into that middle 40 to 60% category, that's where we start to see, a little bit of additional, or a little bit of a mix, shall we say, of, ranging from zero to plus or minus 1 or 2%. And then moving into the higher load factor categories is where we start to see across the different sizes of customers, a larger or a positive, shall I say, average transmission cost impact. So the customers that have a higher load factor in general are the ones who will be seeing an increase in the transmission cost. And this is averaged across all of those customers in that category. Customers and pods, I should say. Along the bottom, we just have the total. So you can see how many are in each of those load factor categories. Slide 55 is the same, same setup on the table. So I'm not going to walk through it in the same type of level of detail, but this is looking at the total bill. So what we've looked at is, what's on the previous slide, transmission costs, adding in those energy commodity costs to come up with the total bill impact. And that's a measure of how much, the change is affecting the total electricity bill. And again, this is calculated for the 2019 year. And what we see is similar to the previous slide. So for customers up to, that zero to approximately 60% load factor, the average change in total bill impact works out to be a decrease. Comparing these to tariff designs. And then it's when you get into above that 60 to 80% and 80 to 100% that the average impact for those customers on a total bill basis is a positive increase. I think that covers it. We wanted to provide, this information so you have a good sense of what's happening across the board. And obviously it's, aggregated and averaged and based on the assumptions we've talked about. So hopefully that's useful to you. And slide 56, we get into a little bit more of the details that we've been talking about throughout this process in terms of how the different types of customers responding to different types of price signals will be impacted. So we wanted to provide this information as it speaks to some of the discussion we've had around, customers that are responding to coincident peak and how they're impacted under this proposed tariff, preferred tariff design. So this table that we're looking at here on the left-hand side has a response to coincident peak. And what this is getting at is sort of the percentage of coincident peak hours that are avoided. So if you're not using energy at the time of coincident peak, your response is high. And if you are using energy at the time of coincident peak, your response to coincident peak is low. The first I'll continue with explaining the table a little bit. So load factor along the top is also presented because, you know, it's really important when we think about the customers that are responding to coincident peak. When we think about the concept of responding to coincident peak, that really ties back and is connected with the load factor because, you know, typically a customer that is low load factor, they're, you know, inherently less likely to be using the system at the time of the coincident peak. Whereas on the other hand, a customer with a relatively higher load factor is more likely to be using energy at those coincident peak times. That's the way the math runs, basically. But it's important to distinguish, you know, when we're thinking about the impacts along those two dimensions, because, you know, we think these are important differences to tease out from the data. So fundamentally, this leads to the third bullet. You know, our conclusion here is that customers with higher load factors and who respond to coincident peaks will have a larger rate impact under the preferred design before any mitigation is applied. So just kind of walking through where that result is coming from, you know, on the bottom of the response to coincident peak, we have that top third of customers who are, you know, pods that are not associated with taking energy at the time of coincident peak. In the load factor category for that bottom line of the table, if you have a relatively low load factor, you're, you know, likely avoiding the coincident peak almost by default, just because you're not using very much energy. And so you're not likely to be using energy at the time of coincident peak, versus another pod where the load factor is very high, where the customer is using much, you know, a lot more energy, but is responding to that coincident peak. And so that's where that 42% is the average transmission cost impact for the group of customers that are in that category. And that's for 2019 as well. Hopefully that explains it. I'm sure we'll get a question on it, but that's the reason we're providing this information, is to tease out those impacts. On the next slide, 57, you know, what we've seen is at an aggregate average level. And so for sure, you know, that's glossing over a lot of important details and, you know, it may not give you the information about what the impact is on your bill. So to give you that kind of clarity and give you that information, we have put together a bill impact tool that's available on our website. So you can download it from our Vulcan Regional Engagement page, and you can input your data to see what the impact is for your site. If you have trouble with the data or would like to get the data file from us, we can help with that. And we'll also be hosting the technical information session just to go over how that tool actually works. And if there's questions, I think there was already one already about, you know, we have been using formulas that weren't available in other versions of Excel. So, you know, we're trying to make it easier for folks to use. And I know a lot of folks have reached out for the data. So that's encouraging. And once we get through that technical session, if there are still questions that you want to ask, by all means, we want to help you with that. So you can reach out to set up a one-on-one meeting just to go over any questions you might have about how the bill impact tool works for your site. The other piece I'll just add is there is more historical data available in that bill impact tool. So if you do want to look back in time for a particular site, you can do that. And, you know, if you know, that leads to further questions and further information that you think would be useful, or if you think there's another way that we can present the bill impact information in a way that would be useful or helpful to you, please let us know. With that, maybe Jordan, I'll pass it back to you to see if we can take some questions.
Brilliant. Let's start with Victoria Ipka.
Hi, friends. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay, thank you for your presentation. I wanted to just point out that a lot of the loads in the province have multiple sites, some directly connected to the transmission system and some connected through the distribution system, and as such need to understand how this proposal will translate through distribution rates. So I have it on good authority that our friends at Fortis Alberta are preparing a calculator to show customers how this proposed ISO rate will flow through to their rate classes. And so this is an opportunity for everyone to thank Fortis for taking that initiative. But I would also like to put a call out to see if our friends at ATCO would do the same thing, because I think that would really benefit customers. And the majority of customers will see this change through their distribution rates. So without that information, I think people are not able to process what the impact on their loads will be. And I would really encourage the ISO and other customers to approach DFOs and ask for this information. We would have it if we all lived in a vertically integrated utility world. So we should probably try to get it in this particular world. The only other thing I wanted to point out that's very obvious, and I'll let other people ask the questions, is what we're doing with this proposed rate design really is penalizing higher load factor customers and penalizing the customers who have actively been managing their risk. And I think that's a very big concern, not just for the few sites that are going to take large hits, but also for Alberta as an attractive place to do business. We're sending the wrong signals to the folks who would use electricity efficiently in our province by penalizing those who use it better. It's just a statement. You don't have to answer it, but, thank you for your presentation. And that's all I have right now, Jordan.
Thanks, Victoria. I bet you Larry and team didn't know that they were going to get an action out of today, but, Larry, maybe give us a high five if you're going to take that action. I'm just kidding. You can take that away. Ed, let's get you in off the sidelines.
Ed DePelzer, Deepak Consulting. Yeah, thanks for the presentation. You know, I guess it's not surprising that if you're going to move a bunch of costs to energy, that the low load factor customers will benefit. But it does seem really, really strange that that's the outcome that we want in an updated design, is to decrease the charges to low load factor customers by up to 20% and then increase them to high load factor customers. And that seems to be a little bit opposite, I would think, of the outcome we want. But as opposed to Victoria, I'd appreciate a response. Like, why is that outcome acceptable to the ISO, and why did they choose this design when it produces that result?
And if I could just maybe I need you to clarify a little bit more into the question too, Ed, but your perspective of and let's view it from the cost reduction side of things, the customers that are low factors today, not having as much of the costs to bear in the future for it, you think that that's an adverse or bad outcome? Is that a fair playback?
Yeah, I think so. I think we've got customers that are, as Victoria said, are being efficient with their use. They're contracting appropriately. They're you know, heavy users of the system, and we're going to increase their costs. And people that don't use the system much because we're putting all the costs on energy, are going to pay less. And so why is sending a signal to the low load factor customers that they get a big rate break from this? Why is that appropriate?
So the move from the variable side of that for some to a bit more of the fixed, where they might be benefiting from that, that's confusing. That makes sense. I understand your question now. That's fair. Spencer, is that something that you can help us to provide some wisdom on?
Yeah, I can try. I won't make any great claims about extending into wisdom or not, but you know, we're thinking about this from the basis of the transmission system as a whole. and how, you know, the use, the different ways that transmission system is used drives costs in the long run. And so I think, you know, I can try to make a principled argument, and that may not satisfy your question necessarily, but that's the basis by which we're approaching this question and coming up with rates that we think are more reflective of the cost that behavior in terms of use of the transmission system drives over time, over the longer time frame. And so, you know, that's how we've approached this problem, and I think, you know, the resulting rates are expected to better reflect how the use of the system is related to costs. And we think that, you know, customers are savvy and will respond to those in a way that'll be more appropriately reflective of how those changes will take place over time, and how that will lead to, you know, further transmission needs or the lack thereof. So, you know, I understand when we look at the impact, you know, that results out of this, it's you know, maybe counterintuitive. And, you know, I think part of it has to do with we're looking at allocating the costs across, you know, the entire system, and, you know, not considering the other costs that the folks incur necessarily to connect to the system, which I think kind of speaks to that conversation we got into a bit earlier about, you know, if you are connected to the system, you are getting benefits and you are paying for that connection through the direct costs that you're imposing to gain access to that system. Once you have that connection in place and you're making use of it, then, you know, the appropriate allocation of costs are costs that are reflective of how that use drives the drives future, you know, transmission costs. And so I think that's a long-winded way of saying, you know, we think we're achieving that through the principles of cost causation. And when we look at the outcomes, we think that they're, you know, again, I can appreciate that it might seem counterintuitive, but we think the impacts are manageable and going to set us forward on the right kind of path for the future.
I have the opinion that might be an agree to disagree type of a comment at the end of the day for it. Ed, can you just clarify if that helps you to understand your rationale?
Well, I think, you know, when you split the costs up into energy and demand up front, you're assuming that, you know, because the generation is higher than load, we're going to give those costs the extra, you know, proportion to that goes to generation, we're going to make that a variable cost and charge it by energy. And but those costs are fixed. Like, those are fixed costs of the transmission system. So when you make it an energy charge, you know, it fits kind of that, oh, that's a generation cost, so we'll make it for energy. But those costs are fixed. They're not going away. So I think that's that, maybe that, you know, assumption to put that on energy right up front, you know, leads to this strange result. And that's something, I don't know, it seems like you should think about again.
Thanks, Ed. So we've got about 7 more minutes planned for just this discussion on bill impact, and we'll let that run right up until for an extra 5 minutes. We'll get to about 12. So what I'll ask is we'll go through Surendra, Colette, Raj, and Paula, and we'll try to kind of keep those around two to three minutes a piece max. And then I'm going to try to rattle through the Q&A that I think we can address all before we close out. So let's start with you, Surendra.
Thanks, Jordan. And it won't take long for my one, because I exactly asked what I was hoping to ask. So, but I was hoping if this slide was presented earlier, I would have asked this question to Richard, since he was expert on this one. And the slide 54 and 55, it just doesn't settle well when you see the table clearly showing the last two, the high load factor cost is increasing, and the first two column is reducing. It just goes against the any marketing economics that thing that we know, right? Higher you use, less you pay normally, but it's just object. And I know, Spencer, you have replied to Ed, so I don't expect you to repeat, but I wonder if Nicole has anything to add, because it is just not setting well.
Okay, thanks, Andrew. Nicole, is that something that you do want to chime in for, or a similar response, kind of the party line up until now?
I think it's a similar response. I'd say we by no means started with the path of seeking out an outcome where lower load factor parties would be paying less. But as Spencer talked through, when we think about the principles that we applied to get to the design that we did, touching back to cost causation, and once you have the buckets of costs, which is the most appropriate billing determinant to charge them to, this is the outcome that that resulted. And I don't mean to say that and we would have just accepted it, but I think what Spencer also added is kind of, and then the looking across the whole range of impacts, which are in that $30 to $50 million on the $2.4 billion that we recover through this tariff, we don't see it. We see it as being, I guess, an acceptably sized impact.
Thanks, Nicole. Let's go, Colette.
Hi, it's Colette Chakurta from the EDC again. I have a couple questions for you, and one is pertaining to the slide that you have up currently. You show all of these cost impacts as a percentage of bill. Is it something that the ISO, like, I guess, you know, A, why isn't this same slide shown as a dollar impact? And can the ISO comment on the dollars that are actually, you know, the 5 to 7% increase in the 80 to 100% load factor for those 28 customers? Like, what is the dollar impact to them? And then what is the dollars then are, you know, that are flowing then to the other numerous pods on the other side? So I guess that's one question. And then the second question is related to this on slide 56. So in the previous slide, you had a 7% impact to the 100% load factor customers that didn't respond to coincident peak, but here you're kind of showing it as 2%. And I don't understand why this is so much lower than what you had in the other slide.
Sure. Yeah, those are good questions. And hopefully we can provide a little bit of additional clarification. And I think at the end of the day, it comes down to averaging and summarizing data. So just to take your first question first, the dollar values we are not showing, and they do matter because they tell a slightly different, more nuanced story, in the sense that, you know, a customer with a low load factor is tending to have a lower bill. And so the percentage change is, you know, somewhat overstated on a dollars basis, if you follow that. So, you know, we didn't provide that dollar information to try to tell that story, but it is, you know, it is important to really have a sense of that. I think, you know, what it comes down to is at the cost, like, you know, an average is only going to tell you so much information. And so that's really where we're relying on that bill impact tool to give you that specific dollar information that's relevant. The second question, which I'm not 100% sure I am tying the right numbers together, but basically, this is just resulting from, you know, we're combining the categories in different ways. And so I think the load factor, you know, categories aren't really corresponding to the same, you know, number of customers on the previous slide. And so that's where the highest impact, you know, and we're also splitting it out into, you know, not into billing capacity, but into that response to coincident peak measure. And so we're separating out customers in a different way that's going to count different impacts, you know, average different impacts across different pods. So that's why, you know, the numbers don't, you know, they're not matching up, is because we're trying to show a little bit of a different aggregation. And then again, it's averaged across, you know, a few different customers. So I think to sum up, it's just the challenge of trying to summarize this, you know, really complex data in a way that we can talk about, and that's informative. So.
Okay. Like, so just a follow-up question. Can you tell me the cost shifting then from the folks that are seeing increases in tariffs to those that are decreasing, like in order of magnitude, is it $20 million? Is it $50 million? Is it $100 million? Like, what is the...
Yeah, the total.
Total.
Yeah, the total is that range between 30 to 50 million, depending on which year we're looking at. So I think for 2019, it was about 40 million. So that's the kind of total change from customers that are paying more, totals up to 40, customers that are paying less, totals up to 40. So hopefully that can...
And of the 28 high load factor customers, what is the portion of that $40 million?
I don't have that information in front of me right now.
I think that's important for the ISO to be able to quickly have those kind of numbers.
Okay, thanks, Clat. Let's go to Raj.
Hi. So I guess you folks have presented a picture, or rather a snapshot of load impacts as of 2019. And in my mind, I'm wondering how this would change as we look forward to the next 5 years. And I potentially see some scenarios unfolding. You know, one is, we are seeing more and more DER being added, distributed energy being added to the system, which potentially can result in a higher energy allocation according to the way it was described. So right now it was something like 40% in certain regions, and potentially it could go up as more generation moves towards the peripheries. That's one factor. The other factor is the energy billing determinants potentially could go down as there is more behind the fence generation or DER being added and netting of generation against supply. So I'm wondering if you folks could provide a forecast of energy billing determinants for the next 5 years with the new energy charge and without the new energy charge.
Okay, I'll take your first question on that. I think the overall point I don't disagree with, and then the specific example, I just want to make sure that we have the same clarity that, you know, when we have increases in generation in general, regardless of where they occur, that could impact the allocation to energy. So that's true. And then I think your specific example about increases in distributed energy resources that are connecting, it really depend where they are and to the extent that they're counted, if you will, in areas that are, you know, that already have or that are close to the peak generation being higher than the peak load. So I think, you know, totally fair point. Just want to make sure that we have that clarity. The second point, you know, it's a good one. And I think, you know, we're putting this information together as a starting point to have this type of discussion. Certainly, you know, when we think about how customers will respond in the future to this, you know, we're no one has the crystal ball to be able to say, you know, this is, you know how customers would likely respond. And I think, you know, I don't mean to dismiss that because I do think it's super important. But I think, you know, the other thing to keep in mind, if you will, is the size of the energy billing determinant in terms of, you know, in relation to the other billing determinants is larger. And so the change in that billing determinant that would result from, you know, a customer's own choice to whether to take energy is going to have a smaller impact than, for example, the customer's choice to make that same decision at the time of coincident peak, where that billing determinant is smaller, and so the impact on the resulting rate is larger. I'll probably leave it there. You know, your point is well taken, but this is what we're starting with, I guess.
Thanks, Raj.
I do just want to add one point, because I think a couple, maybe to follow on to Raj, your question around, and it's come up a couple times around how the energy charge is going to be a little bit higher, and that may incent parties to self-supply to in response to that. But I think to add on to what Spencer already was talking about around how that will impact the actual charge, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that in this in the change in the rate design, we're also shifting or reducing the 12 CP charge, which has also been historically a signal that people were, that loads were responding to and developing generation on. So you can't just, we can't just in isolation look at the change in the energy charge to evaluate the overall shift in the economic proposition for self-supply generation. You have to look at the full mix of the generation, the rate design, as well as the implications for what the generation's operation would have to look like in order to avoid or reduce the energy charge, the energy and the CP charge.
Thanks, Nicole. Thanks for your question, Raj. We're at 1:50. This is where I was going to cut it off, but I did promise that we'd get Paula in and do more of the rapid fire through the Q&A. So let's get Paula's question. We're going to try to keep this one punctual as well, Paula.
Thank you. I had two questions. One was the same as Colette's. Is then I see the percentages and I see lots of stuff going lower, but I want to see the full amount and understand what sectors are being hit more. Is it pulp and paper? Is it petrochemicals? What is being hit more on a dollar basis? So I encourage you guys to provide that those numbers on a magnitude amount, on a quantum amount versus a percentage. The other question I had for you is a trailing 5 years 12 CP. It's almost like it's sort of already calculated, and you're trying to sort of, if you change your load behavior where say you're adding energy storage, then how do you get rid of this 5 year trailing 12 CP that you've already made some changes to your peak? How does that modify? Maybe I'm not understanding this appropriately, but suppose I'm a pet chem and I put in a very large energy storage facility. I'm no longer having coincident peaks, but historically I have. How long till I get rid of my baggage? Not saying it was baggage, but you know what I mean.
I know what you mean. So we talked about this a little bit, but just to recap, you know, we do think it's appropriate to phase that in over time. Which is why we haven't included it in the assumptions here. So we're not going retroactive. We're not saying that the last 5 years are going to matter for your bill going forward. What we're planning to do is say, you know, once these rates become effective, that's when we're going to start counting, you know, as we move forward. So once the rates are effective that year, the next year, the following year, we'll start to increase the amount of time that we're averaging over.
So sounds like there could be a very big demand for large-scale energy storage for high-load customers then. Is that the direction that this would incent people or high loads?
I think you have to look at it holistically. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in terms of both the energy cost and the coincident peak.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks, Paul. I want to go through the Q&A for it. We were able to go through what's actually there. And I'm going to do my best to make this more binary and quick answers with you, Spencer, and then we're going to move on to the next one. So first question, Richard Stout, will the ISO conduct a price response study and modify the bill impact analysis to reflect this dynamic? Binary if possible.
I'm going to say unlikely, but we welcome your feedback on that question.
Okay. Next question. If the majority of pods by total bill have a lower amount, how is the ISO covering all of the cost? Is this mostly at the residential level?
So we collect the entirety of the revenue requirement, and the change, you know, is the percentage changes when we're averaging across customers gives that appearance, but it's a function of the averaging, and you know, we do recover the entire revenue requirement.
Okay.
And that the data is presented by a percentage range. So while you, it may look like there are more pods with a reduction, the in the end, the same amount of revenues being recovered.
Okay. Have you considered the DOE review of the recommendations on the status of self-supply and export policy in your tariff considerations?
As I mentioned at the start of the morning, we're going forward within the current policy or legislative framework that's underway today. That's, I think, the response to that question.
Okay. And last question snuck in there. It would feel weird to move past it, but was there any consideration to shift costs from the CP charge to the capacity charge rather than to an energy charge? That way, high load factor customers may not be impacted as much.
Yeah, this kind of gets back into our rate design discussion this morning, but you know, we looked at several different alternatives and ultimately are moving forward with the one we think is most cost reflective.
Okay. Thanks, Spencer. Surrender, I still see your hand. We are going to move on. We're 10 minutes over and we're going to move forward and have a discussion about mitigation. Rather, yeah. The path to achieve minimal disruptions, maybe a better introduction into that.
thanks. So I'm taking the reins from here for the next few slides to discuss what is one of the critically important components of the overall proposal to make sure that we're meeting our objectives of better reflecting cost responsibility, efficient price signals, but implementing this change in a way that puts the long-term rate design on a path that we think will send the more appropriate signals for investors and consumers, but not in a manner that comes with an undue burden for the consumers that have made decisions on how to invest and operate under the current rate design. And so I'm going to talk through what we heard out of our last session and then really shift into the process that we are kicking off and engaging the significantly impacted loads on and to share with a broader group before going into that targeted engagement, some of the high level starting points that ISO is taking forward into that engagement. So as a reminder for all of us, just to recap what we had heard out of the December 10th session regarding mitigation, noting that this feedback was provided before anyone had seen where the preferred design had landed and the impact to customers. So we're just acknowledging that maybe some of these aspects would be reconsidered now that the rate design is known, but the comments have guided our thinking in coming up with or the starting points that we want to take into the mitigation conversations. The big one being, or as a whole, really, we're setting out the, to some degree, the threshold of seeking a minimal disruption implementation by working with those customers who will see a transmission cost impact of 10% or more, to seek an approach to provide mitigation that can support them in transitioning to this new rate design. Of note, Spencer just walked through and presented the transmission cost impact as well as the total transmission bill. Historically, as the Commission, Alberta Utilities Commission, has reviewed rate applications from the ISO, it has focused in on the total bill, so including energy impact, but as Spencer walked through the analysis and we've identified that there are a handful or a few of customers that will see what might be less than a 10% increase to their total bill, a significant change to their transmission cost, especially for these customers who electricity cost is a important or a high input cost into their business, and they have been working or in making operation and investment decisions historically to look to mitigate that cost. We want to make sure that as we go forward, we're working with them to find a path that allows us and them to transition forward effectively to the new rates. If we go to this next slide, really what's driving that, and then which is a key and important component for us as we go forward, is we have identified an issue and a concern with the current rate design, that we do think it can result in cost shifting amongst customers, and in the current setup of the design, sending price signals that we think left unchecked could perpetuate into the future and create greater and greater concerns around cost shifting and overall questions around the sustainability of the rate design. But as I said, that doesn't mean we're looking to significantly impact those that have been responding to the current rates that have been in place. They've been in place for several decades now, and they have been investment signals that have been stable, and it's important to help these customers transition through this change. And that's important to all customers, because there's no, as we talked about back in our last session, these significantly impacted customers, if their business is impacted so much and they end up leaving the grid, that actually comes at a cost to everyone, because then there's just less parties sharing in what is the cost of the infrastructure that's been put into place. And so with that, I think what we see, while the significantly impacted customers nobody likes to see a cost increase, so they're not, they probably don't see this as an opportunity, but what the ISO sees is an opportunity for us here now, in advance of putting forward our application, a chance to take advantage of some flexibility that we have to us leading up to preparing the application and working collaboratively across ISO and the significantly impacted loads to seek out a mutually acceptable approach to transition those customers onto the new rate design. And that's something that's really going to be important to us in the next couple months as we lead up to preparing the application, because we see it as a key pillar of success to shifting into this new rate design for the province, and have flagged it as a key objective from day one. If we shift into the next slide, what we are intending to do to share information a bit for this bigger, broader group, because the significantly impacted loads that we're working with are going to get more details than this as we meet with them one-on-one. But at a starting point, as you would have seen from the material that Spencer's taken us through, the significant increases are limited to a pretty small number of customers. The bill impact tool, or we've reached out to anybody that we've estimated would see a transmission bill increase of greater than 10%. And the bill impact tool can allow other customers to get a sense and a level of understanding of the impact that we estimate for them. And as we've said, we want to help everyone build that up for understanding, and are making ourselves available in the session scheduled for next week. But where we shift to really the targeted engagement, as I mentioned, we want to work with this small group to strive to find a mutually acceptable option or set of options that we can include as part of our application to the commission. We will be working closely with that group of customers, but would want to, or will bring back the proposal to the broad stakeholder group as part of, as at least as part of session six, maybe in advance of that session, so that there's an opportunity for the broader stakeholder group to have a visibility and understanding of what that option is looking like, and then as well seek your feedback on it. The ISO would be putting forward kind of the materials or summaries out of the target engagement and the actual agreement that we land on. Should we not get to an agreement, then maybe the next best thing of options that identified and the reasons why there was an agreement to any particular option, that would be included as part of the application to the commission, as well as any information that we gather from this broader group around the mitigation proposal. And then at the end of the day, it is really in the commission's authority to approve this mitigation proposal. But what we see as the opportunity is to work with those stakeholders now early, build up what is hopefully an agreement to put forward to the commission, so that the considerations and approval can be a bit more streamlined, in the sense that, or in the hopes that there's some agreement around it. If we switch to the next slide, please, on 63, as I mentioned, the parties that we're engaging for this targeted mitigation, we have reached out to them, and it is anyone with a transmission cost impact based on our estimates of greater than 10%. And as I mentioned, we think that that finds the balance between less of an impact than maybe the Hoare Commission would have historically looked at, but we still think still significant. But acknowledging that in this shift, there will be certain parties that will see an increase under that amount, that to some degree isn't getting addressed or isn't getting addressed in this mitigation proposal. As we look at that 10% threshold, there are seven individual sites that exceed the threshold. They range across four industries. When we look at the magnitude of amount of those sites, looking at their estimated impact and getting to a 10% increase, we estimate that's up to $8 million. And the materials that Spencer walked us through, you would have noticed that there were more than seven pods identified in the histogram with impacts greater than 10%. We're not including the DFO related pods in this targeted engagement, because the overall impact to those pods bill is a function more of the total costs that are allocated to the DFO and not just the specific pod themselves. So we're focusing in on either sites that are directly connected to the transmission system or are on the flow through rates that distribution companies provide to those sites. Switching into the frame that ISO is taking into this engagement as a starting point, and I do really want to highlight it's a starting point. We wanted to put this information out for the broader group to gather input, and then also, I guess, start with a frame with the impacted customers to work from. Our intent is to seek an agreement. And so these are, as they're called, starting principles. They're not final principles. The amount of give and take on any of them might be independent or might be individually assessed as we go forward, and the importance of any give and take is likely also guided by what the impacted loads see as value for them, and we want to seek that out with the group. But as a set of starting principles, sharing them here, I'll just walk through them quickly. As we've as I've mentioned, we're focusing in the mitigation conversations to those customers that will see a 10% increase to their transmission bill to seek out ways to mitigate that impact to them. We want our principle for us is that the mitigation options adapt with design and rates. And this is really just to acknowledge that we don't know with certainty what the future rates will be exactly. And so an approach that relies more on methodologies or formulas that adapts to the actual rates is a value to us, or we see that as being a value to the process. We also hope to find what is a consistent application. So options that can be applied to any impacted load and not just specifically matches what one particular customer may need or value. But again, this is a starting principle. We are seeking options that we can implement with our current set of tools. So something that's administratively simple. We don't want to create new metering, new settlement tools, things like that. That's again a starting principle. And a big one being around we're seeking something that's mutually acceptable. And so that's mutually acceptable to ISO and the significantly impacted loads, but also taking into consideration input from the broader stakeholder group, acknowledging that at the end of the day, it is the Alberta Utilities Commission's decision, and they'll have to balance all the aspects of public interest in their decision. To close the loop, if we could go to the next slide around the options that we had presented back in December, just to refresh everyone's memory, we presented the first three columns, which is kind of a type of mitigation options, some categories, some descriptions. We also had examples in the table. I've removed those. But what I wanted to augment this with was an evaluation, ISO's initial evaluation of each of the options, just given where we've landed with the preferred rate design, as well as the resulting impact estimates that we've seen just earlier today. And so going through each of the items just at a high level, and again, acknowledging these are starting assessments, we want to explore if there are any of these that are of value to the companies that are facing or the sites that are facing a significant increase. We want to explore them and see where we can seek agreement on their implementation. But starting at the top around the transition rate design, we had originally contemplated a phasing in of tariff changes. The example talked about kind of phase in the change over X number of years. Given the relatively small number of load customers or sites that are seeing a significant increase, we do think targeted mitigation may be a more effective choice. And so that's the assessment at this point for that first option. The second item was around an adjustment period where the examples there were allowing people like a contract reset or a contract holiday where, given the new rates, how do they want to change either their contract levels or their assumed use of the grid? As we look at the preferred rate design and we see there's an overall reduction in the billing capacity component, we're not sure how much value this option will have for customers, but are willing to explore that. The third one gets to rate class. And this was really as we were in the earlier days of rate design and exploring what were some more of those kind of bookend scenarios. We were thinking there was a possibility that maybe there was more unique rate classes for customers that use the system differently. But as we've gone forward and we're still having kind of the same billing determinants that we have now, looking at cost causation arguments that led us to the the preferred rate design that it did. We didn't see or didn't identify any specific rate classes that we felt needed to be could be added that aligned with the cost causation arguments that were leading us to our rate design. The last one around bill adjustments, the area that one of the areas we want to explore with the impacted customers, I think transitionary bill impact credits is one that we want to talk about. It may be a potential option to support the transition. We've permanent bill credits are less of a preference for us. We think that the mitigation should be supporting a minimally disruptive transition and allowing those customers to respond to the new rates and not providing a permanent sort of legacy treatment under the existing rates. Those are the initial assessments. In when you receive the comment matrix from us, you'll see we're asking questions of the broad stakeholder group around both the principles and this assessment to seek any input you may have for us to take forward into the targeted engagement. But for the 7 sites that we're going to work with more closely, we're going to have a lot more detailed conversations on all of these components. If we switch to slide 66, it talks about the schedule for this process. So we're in the process of having the one-on-one meetings with impacted loads. We want to make sure they understand our estimates of bill impact to them, answer any questions, and then start talking about the process we want to follow. Jordan from STAC is going to be supporting the ISO, facilitating those processes going forward too. We are looking to seek a mutual agreement out of them, but we will also, should that not be possible, just seek as much agreement or information to support the overall process that we can. We plan to be working with these groups through April and May. Partway through the process, we'll be getting the feedback from this broad stakeholder group, which can inform that conversation. And then we're also seeking to make sure that the broad stakeholder group has a view as to where we've landed. And we'll be sharing that information when it's available out of the process sometime in May, late May. So that's
past minimal disruption. Any questions for Nicole? See a Q&A question coming in at this point. It's more of a statement or assertion, I suppose, but just commenting about $8 million and missing the higher amount and finding that a little disappointing for it. So thanks for your comment, Kim. Let's go to Dwayne's question. Let's get Dwayne off the line. Hey, Dwayne.
Good afternoon. Dwayne, Dow Chemical. Just real quick, the transitional. Is transition measured in months, years, or decades?
That's something we want to explore with the impacted companies to understand what it's going to be required to be to achieve that path of minimal disruption.
So it's an open discussion then?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Paulette?
Oh, hi, it's Colette Chakurta again. I just have a question with respect to, I think I have a pretty good understanding of the 7 impacted customers and the work that's ahead. I guess my question is in respect to the 28 high load factor customers that could be seeing increases in that potentially 5 to 10%, like under 10%, but material in terms of dollars. What is, clearly there could be an economic jobs impact to those companies. And has the ISO done any research or analysis on that? And are they considering any mitigation for those particular customer segment?
So we've I think we've been using the historical commission's guidance of a 10% threshold and taken that from total bill to transmission bill to guide us in defining the threshold that we're looking to take forward in these very targeted mitigation discussions, acknowledging that there are other customers that will see an increase. I think there's two aspects there that we'd like to, I guess, hear from the all stakeholders of is the definition of the threshold of this 10% transmission bill increase that ISO's defined. Is it reasonable and appropriate? And if so, why or why not? And then also, I think there's an aspect of the principle around allowing these options that we land with the significantly impacted loads, one of the principles being that it can be consistently applied. I think that's an aspect where the mitigation that we land on with this group, should the commission determine that it should be applied to a broader suite of consumers that are seeing an impact, part of the design would be, or part of the principle, one of the principles that we've set out is that it would be able to apply to more loads than just the sites that we're working with here.
And Kate, and maybe just a follow-up. So that, you know, I'd mentioned before, there's about a $40 million kind of shift between, you know, the ones that see increases and the ones that see decreases on a, you know, almost $2.5 billion revenue requirement. You know, for that impact, you know, which is relatively small in the grand scheme of things, has the ISO done any analysis as to what the economic and job impact and what this could potentially do to the investment climate in Alberta for those energy intensive, trade exposed manufacturing sector customers?
We haven't done any such analysis for those that would see an increase or a decrease.
Okay, thank you.
All right, any other hands up?
Not at this point. Looks like you were on the move.
I am on the move. My dogs are about to be very loud, so I'm saving you all from that. There's a discussion in the Q&A. There's discussion about having one-on-one conversations with load to customize what their billings may be. Should this be transparent and consistent between loads? If you're deferring charges, who picks up the bill? Maybe just a view to how that mitigation process might address those questions, Nicole.
Yeah, that's that highlights the or where we look to have that addressed, knowing that it's not just these seven customers, but the broad stakeholder group that can be impacted at the end of the day by the choices that we make around this mitigation. That's why we're looking to get feedback from the broad group to consider in the process through the April 15th comment matrix, as well as reporting back from the mitigation discussions to the broader group before we finalize that process.
Okay, hopefully that answers your question, Paula. It's definitely an intention of transparency. Last question to Victoria, and then we're going to go on to a revised break.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Victoria Bellissimo with IPCA. My concern here is not something new that you haven't heard before, but we're talking a low end of a $30 million cost shift, $8 million of mitigation. And I guarantee you the seven customers who you're talking to on that front are probably going to need the high end of that. So we might as well count that as the full 8 million, possibly more than that, possibly a $5 million hearing. So, and at the same time, we don't have any information from the government on changes to the TREG and changes to self-supply and export. For me, we're spending a lot of administrative dollars and mitigation dollars to get to a very small change in compared to the overall cost of the tariff. I'm just wondering if you have some thoughts on whether or not it's worth it right now.
I think that goes back to the conversation around the case for change and material that we provided back in December. And I think really comes down to, we do think it's important to get the right the right signals in place. What we are seeing historically as the 12 CP costs have been increasing, we're seeing more and more response to that price signal. And we don't think it's a sustainable, appropriate price signal to continue on in the long term. And so the longer that we defer putting this change in, I think the more investors and operation investment and operation decisions will be made that we'll have to come back to and kind of that path, the disruption that will be caused once we do make the change will be even larger.
And I guess I would just ask that you can consider it from the other perspective. You've got 7, possibly more consumers in the province who are already under a significant amount of stress because they're trying to operate their businesses during a global pandemic. And at the same time, now they're having to analyze the impact of a major cost shift that could cost them millions of additional dollars annually. So I worry that we're not being fair to those customers by doing what we're doing right now.
Okay. Thanks, Victoria. I think we'd hear you loud and clear on that element too. So definitely noted. 2:25, we're going to take a break here at this point. We were originally scheduled for a 15-minute break. I'm going to take 5 of that. So we're going to give everyone a 10-minute break. We'll be back here at 2:35 to discuss energy storage. All right. We will move the con over to Steve Waller to walk us through some of the energy storage discussion and how that's being treated in the tariff. So over to you, Steve.
I'm jumping in quick first.
All right.
Before handing it over to Steve, where it looks like we're blue skying it here for energy storage. I had to get one bad joke in. I don't know if everyone caught the Cheerios one. Just as a reminder for everyone, in November we'd heard a few proposals from energy storage developers around what they thought there are considerations for energy storage tariff treatment should look like. And we reported back in December around our continued focus of making sure that we treat all users of the grid, including energy storage, in as technology agnostic manner as we can. And we're looking at how energy storage, like other users of the system, has inflows and outflows, and that's really a big factor in our evaluation, but also acknowledging that how energy storage uses the grid may be a bit more or a lot more elastic than other types of consumers, and so we were going back and evaluating the non-firm rate options that we'd identified. And so Steve's going to talk you through the options that we'd identified and the evaluations that we've done on them. And the one that stood out for us as something to explore from a tariff modernization lens is the demand opportunity service rate that exists now. It's a rate that looks to allow customers that wouldn't have otherwise used the system or taken a DTS rate to actually use or take some energy from the grid at a, we'll say, a reduced rate at the benefit of providing that revenue to all customers to offset the costs of the transmission system. But the key focus being making sure that we hone in on eligibility that doesn't lead to artificial reduction in DTS charges or DTS use of the system, which is the more firm planning types access that we plan for. So Steve's going to walk you through all of that and kind of end off with the conclusion that we still have a bit of evaluation to do around that eligibility component to capture that risk that I just mentioned, and also look at some modernization aspects around how DOS would be, I guess, how we'd receive the info around when the service or the rate would be used and how to deal with constraints or managing, limiting the opportunity service when the constraint would occur. So looking forward to hearing your questions for further information, your reactions as we go through this one, and I'll turn it over to Steve.
Thanks, Nicole. Thanks for the rest of you sticking around till the bitter end here. If we flip to the next slide, that should be number 70. Yeah. Last time we talked, we picked up on a couple of themes from session 4. We'd heard that the current rates reflect really one class of service, and that's a service around firm load and serving that firm load. And that the ISO should consider rates that reflect the different types of uses of the system. And that there were three forms of tariff treatment that could reflect different uses of the system. One that utilizes the unused transmission capacity that would normally not occur otherwise. Another that allows us to defer build through curtailments or must-take requirements. And the last one, a rate that would encourage energy and ancillary service market participation. And we'll talk about each of these in a little more detail on the next slide, 71. So we performed an assessment of these three types of non-firm options, and I've summarized this assessment. This very dense slide here. And I'll walk through this table from left to right, starting with the first column, where we go through a description of how that rate would behave, the rationale behind it, and then ultimately our conclusion about that particular option. So the first one is really an interruptible rate for the purposes of transmission deferral in column one. There we would see a demand reduction for inflow constraints. We would also see demand increases for outflow issues that would occur on the system. And the value would be reflected in the rates rather than through service provision under this configuration. The rationale there is that it would really identify a need for a specific location. In other words, this rate would be very locational specific. We'd need to interrupt the load to manage the transmission constraints or bring load potentially on, depending on what the situation was. And if in the end, the goal would be to lower future transmission costs through the use of this rate. But our conclusions are really that this rate reflects transmission cost savings from load changes to relieve constraints that have a strong locational component, and therefore there are obviously some issues with setting locational based rates. In the second column, we talk about rates that encourage market participation. So the idea here is that we would reduce DTS rates everywhere, but it would only be eligible to loads or storage that participate in the market or participate in the various reliability services, OR, TMR, that kind of thing. The rationale there is that this type of rate there is some reliability value, I should say, in having this type of rate, and it would increase market participation. Our conclusions on looking at that rate are that participants that actively participate really do not impose different costs, transmission costs, than those that don't participate. And also the market is already compensates service providers or those services within the market rather than through a rate. And that brings us to our last column, which is making or utilizing excess capacity that's available on the grid. The description here is you get a discount relative to some of your capacity and to encourage use of that system that would not otherwise occur. So you could only use this available capacity, obviously, when it's available. And its intention would be to offset the cost of other consumers. It's really for the purposes of revenue maximization. The rationale behind this will encourage the efficient use of capability without incurring additional transmission costs. And the ISO can recall the service, and the load must curtail when that service is recalled. Our conclusions around this particular option are that the use of available capacity capability that would not otherwise occur is a benefit to all stakeholders, provided it is used in its use, would truly not otherwise occur under rate DTS. So if we go to the next slide. So the ISO has considered all these options to reflect different use cases of the grid and has identified that energy storage could make use of transmission capability that would not otherwise occur. And in doing so, this would benefit other consumers and help reduce the need for additional transmission capacity. And Demand Opportunity Service is an existing rate that does exactly that. Or DOS, as it's otherwise known as, allows customers to connect to the grid to draw additional power over and above the amount they're contracted for under DTS as a means of reducing DTS charges for all customers. That service is interruptible, it's temporary, and available only when the surplus transmission capacity is available. Currently, it's renewed annually, and there are three types of DOS based on the timing for interruptibility, first two are anyway, 7-minute DOS, 1 hour, and a term DOS. And I'll get into a little more details on those in the next slide. Another key point around DOS currently is that losses are charged 2 megawatts under this rate. And participants, in order to get this rate, need to pre-qualify for it. So if we slip to slide 73. So here's a quick refresher on the three types of DOS and how the rates were derived. For those who are really interested in the rationale behind this rate, this is documented in paragraphs 229 to 233 of the ISO's 2010 tariff application. By the way, there was a typo in our slides when we originally published the 220 application. It's actually the 210 application. In a nutshell, the DOS rates were derived from DTS and then converted over to a dollar per megawatt hour charge. The 7-minute DOS, it's made up of the bulk and regional energy charges of DTS, as well as the operating reserve charges. And that forms the DOS 7-minute rate. The 1 hour DOS rate is made up of the bulk and regional energy charges plus 50% of the bulk and regional fixed demand charges, as well as of the operating reserve charges from DTS. And term DOS, which is even more expensive, is a bulk and regional energy charges plus 100% of the bulk non-energy charges plus 1,200% of the, or 100% times 12 of the non-energy regional system charges. And this represents the full DTS charge converted over to dollars per megawatt hour and is really intended to help avoid DTS ratchets in the event of a generation outage for sites that self-supply. So this is effectively where the rates came from. And again, I'd point you to the 2010 application for a better explanation of how those numbers were derived. And the other thing I'll point out is, yes, so 7-minute DOS, when instructed by the system controller, you have up to 7 minutes to remove that that DOS load from the system. Conversely, 1 hour DOS, but you have an hour. And then term DOS is not really, again, when you're directed by the system controller to not take that energy, you must take it off. But I don't know if there's a, I'd have to double check if there's a time restriction on it, but the intention of term DOS is that it gets pre-approved prior to you using it to ensure that there is capacity available, and then you would use it for that term. And it's, like I said, typically used when there's a generator outage on sites that typically self-supply and avoids the ratchet of DTS. So if you can flip to slide 74. There are also some key terms and conditions for DOS. And it's primarily around how you qualify, and what are the eligibility requirements, and also how you in or near real time ask to use that DOS energy. So first one is the pre-qualification requirements. The current DOS has a non-refundable $5,000 fee that must be paid annually to receive DOS or just to apply for DOS. It requires the participant to provide their anticipated frequency of use of the DOS energy, as well as an estimate of the megawatt hours per month that they would expect to use. The current eligibility criteria states that the use of this capacity would otherwise not occur under any other rate, and that's important. There must be sufficient capacity to take this DOS energy, and that energy is temporary for repeated short-term use. So DOS recipients must have an alternative energy source or a market opportunity to in order to pass the eligibility criteria. The market participant must be, the market opportunity must be an opportunity where the cost of receiving the additional electric energy under rate DTS renders the opportunity uneconomic. So once you've got through the eligibility requirement, then DOS requires that you submit a transaction request when you actually want to use the DOS energy. The DOS capacity can only be used 45 days following your pre-qualification, so not immediately. And then prior to its use, you must submit that formal transaction request to the ISO, as well as, if approved, a $500 per month, roughly, application or request fee. I don't know what the right term is for that. But anyway, these are kind of the key terms and conditions of DOS that we want to consider in detail when we look to modernize our DOS rate. So if we go to slide 75. So the ISO has revised this view from what was submitted in our 2018 tariff. Based on what we have learned since then, we now feel that the DOS rate may be revised to allow an expanded eligibility. Our goal is to keep the overall intent of DOS the same. In other words, encourage the use of the capacity that would otherwise go unused and provide incremental value, but also look for ways in which we can modernize DOS to encourage a greater use. But we still have a fair bit of work to do here to set an effective criteria. We must find that tricky balance that allows customers to make use of this additional transmission capacity that is available, but at the same time eliminate the potential for customers to rely on DOS as a means of avoiding DTS charges. We also want to modernize DOS, the DOS transaction, so that it is easier for DOS providers to access the DOS capacity when it's available, and simplify how it's curtailed when it isn't available. And if we go to the 76. So that was a quick run through on all of this, and we are seeking your feedback. What we'd like to hear your initial thoughts on these two questions. Is DOS a suitable rate for a portion of energy storage's charging capacity? And if so, we're interested in your thoughts on how to assess eligibility. What are the different mechanisms that the ISO could employ to ensure that those requesting DOS are only taking that energy that would not otherwise be consumed, thereby avoiding the risk that DTS is cannibalized by DOS? And then using your feedback, the ISO will continue to progress this file and present a recommendation at session 6. So that brings me to my quick run through of what we're doing in energy storage, and I'd now like to hear your questions.
All right, let's open the floodgates with Travis first. Travis went away. Let's go to Dan.
Thanks very much, everybody. Dan Chapman, Chapman Ventures. Thanks for the commentary and the materials, Steve. Have a question about slide 72. You can bring that up. Mm-hmm. And it relates to the first point where you talk about the condition that an asset that's qualifying for DOS can't drive the need for additional transmission capacity. I'm wondering how that relates to a greenfield asset that would have, say, a hybrid renewables co-located with energy storage. So there's transmission, you know, if there was a transmission need that's being dealt with under, you know, the need for generation to be connected, and whether there is a differing thoughts on treatment related to the market participation classification of a hybrid renewables plus storage versus the independent asset renewables plus storage. Thank you.
Again, the DOS rate itself typically would sit over and above the DTS rate. And when this particular application applied to the grid for connection, you would connect just like any other connection and pay whatever the requirements are for getting connected. And then would indicate how much of that energy is your DTS energy, and then conversely, how much of that energy you think you would only be using under the terms and conditions of DOS. And one of the key components of DOS is that this is energy that would otherwise go unused under rate DTS. I hope that answered your question.
Does that help answer your question, Dan?
Yeah, partially. I just wanted to try to unpack that comment a bit, you know, in that first point. I'll think about that more and come back if I have more questions.
Okay. I don't want to punish Travis for what I think was just a missing finger snap. So let's get Travis up next, and then we're going to go Robert because we haven't heard from him yet, and then Paula. Travis.
Thanks. I lowered my hand to make sure I didn't leave it up afterwards, and I was too quick. So thank you for this. It's very helpful. I have a few questions, and I think Nicole and Steve, your commentary has helped. So you're looking at DOS, but is it fair to say that you also think there's going to be some changes to it as you potentially refine to accept energy storage in along with the availability to all other load customers?
Sorry, I'm sorry. I dismissed something happened on my internet, and I missed the last half of your question.
Really, just is DOS? It's not just DOS you're proposing. You think that there might be changes to DOS as well as part of, as you call it, modernizing.
Right. Okay. Yeah, and we're primarily looking not so much at the changing the spirit of DOS. DOS, as I said earlier, was derived from DTS and turned into a dollar per megawatt hour rate. I think we're, you know, thinking that would more or less stay the same. but at the same time, a lot of the issues with DOS are around its eligibility and around some of the mechanisms or processes that customers need and the ISO need to go through in order to use that DOS energy. So again, that's why we say we're looking to modernize DOS to make it a more effective and efficient.
Understood. Okay. And then kind of building on that, kind of two other related questions so you talk about sufficient transmission capacity, and given the kind of natural operating condition of storage to charge in off peak and discharge during peak, would the DOS or ASO through this process kind of look at a typical consumption profile of storage when it's chasing a market opportunity for transmission capacity in those off peak hours? Or, and I guess put another way, it's not like a firm capacity, it's more of a firm in certain hour transmission capability.
Yeah, I'm not sure I can quite answer that yet. This is the area we need to do a lot more work on, and look to your input on to how you think we best do that. Like I said, this is finding that tricky balance between, making better use of the transmission system that is available to us while at the same time not having everyone flood over to rate DOS because we've lowered the bar to a place where it's no longer a revenue maximization rate.
Right. Okay.
And maybe to flip it to you, Travis, to that end, do you think that a DOS Plus would meet the needs and be able to serve the way that an energy storage resource would want it to or need it to?
Yeah. So I think it was helpful with the three columns of the chart. I think it's on the slide 71, maybe, or 70,
71.
Going 71, that in my mind, that first column is really the ASO with transmitters saying storage makes sense to meet, to be a non-wires alternative and should be compensated outside of the tariff. I know I'd actually have funds. So that makes sense. I agree with your conclusion. So when you land to the third column, then yes, you're heading in the right direction of an interruptible RAID. And I think you've hit on the key things is what is the definition for storage as a market opportunity? And I would assume the conversation is going to come down to if you have the wrong rate set up from a tariff point of view, storage is going to have an eliminated market opportunity. They're not going to have enough of a capability to go through. So that might be, from a fairness and equitable point of view, a way to have storage be able to use DOS more fully compared to an end use customer that is drawing out of the system and never kind of providing a flow back. I do have to think about it a little bit more now that you've talked, but I think it's helpful. And that's at least where my head is going back. I think there's two last questions. I'll have one is, I believe I'm reading it correctly that it's not, you wouldn't see storage using only DOS. At this time, the ASO's view is that there would still be some DTS component for the install, the maximum charging capacity or registered DTS capacity of storage still there, and then DOS would sit on top.
More than likely. The reason I say that is all storage facilities have some form of station service and some minimum charging level that they would need to at least charge, right?
Right.
So, there would at least be some level of DTS in which DOS would sit on top of this.
Okay.
And then, Travis, I just want to get some other folks involved in the conversation too. So I'm going to ask you just to drop your hand, throw her back up. We'll still get you in queue, but I do want to hear from some other folks as well.
Thank you.
Let's go Robert and then Paula.
I got to jump into one thing. Sorry, Jordan. Sure. Travis used the word kind of firmed energy storage he used the word twice. I just want to clarify, there's nothing firm about DOS. It's an opportunity service. If there's available capability that's identified through the process and when you pass the eligibility criteria to sort of prove that you wouldn't have otherwise used the energy under DTS, then DOS is provided, but in an opportunity service. And if there's a constraint, your consumption gets curtailed or reduced.
Okay. I feel like I have to bring Travis back to close off that conversation now. So let's get Travis unmuted.
Thank you, Nicole. My point, and thanks, Jordan. I don't want to take up all the time, but it was really on the eligibility criteria and saying sufficient transmission capacity. And this is to get in. So it's not in the real time where you're say the system's getting tight, you're the first one getting kicked off. It's in the eligibility. And I just wanted to make sure it wasn't like you were looking at the system and saying there's capacity in the system when we add it up by all the DTSs. It's capacity with some sort of load profile. So you're not going to reject storage that would actually increase utilization of a transmission asset. Okay, I'm seeing nods, so that's good.
The evaluation of that would be technology agnostic too. Like if energy storage has a different profile, that's fine. But the evaluation of capacity wouldn't be actually specific to a type of technology. Right.
We storage would just look like an off-peak consumer and flat during all on-peak. That makes sense. Okay, thank you.
Okay. So I want to go Robert and then Paula, and then we're going to go through the queue as planned. So Robert first.
Great. Thanks, Jordan and Keith. My first comment is, you know, storage is most likely going to participate and look like a generation unit. And generation units such as peakers utilize the transmission that is paid for them, maybe 10% of the time, and it's sitting there idle the rest of the time. And I don't see why that's different for a storage asset. So I think there is still a competitive issue here that needs to be resolved. The other thing that I want to get your comment on is DOS right now, and this is something that we brought up years ago when DOS was suggested, was that it's not firm. You only get it for the 12 months that you've applied. So is that what's being envisioned here for storage, that you would have to reapply for it every year?
I think what we're saying is we want to look at the criteria in the effort of modernizing DOS and looking at where we can make it a better and usable rate for customers. So I guess we're wanting to hear from stakeholders where your sticky points are with the current DOS and help us understand why DOS isn't currently working. It is currently only very, very rarely utilized. I think there's two or three customers currently using it. And so we'd like to better understand what's getting in the way of the use of DOS. And so we're open to hear from you what suggestions do you think would help.
Right. So other than, the price, but that's something that will come out of the calculations. The issue that we've had with DOS historically has been that we're building a 30 plus year asset. And how can you have the uncertainty on what is one of your largest costs on a year to year basis? And so this comes back to the risk that is on the facility, similar to the risk of hitting a CP12 event. What is the uncertainty in the costs so that asset is exposed to? And having something that's renewed every 12 months provides an additional uncertainty, which reduces the economics.
Okay. Understood.
Yeah. Thanks, Rob. If I'm hearing you correctly, too, maybe in contrast to Travis, you've got further heartache with that DOS as a starting position. On how that might permit or allow a technology like energy storage to participate?
I mean, we've been looking at this for a very long time, right? And we've looked at DOS before. We've even talked, I think we talked to the ISO about it like 5 or something years ago. And yeah, it might be able to work. And you know, we walked through when I presented my alternatives. One of the alternatives was a non-firm rate that was open to all customers. It was an interruptible rate. But it was long-term. One of the points was that it's available for an asset to sort of lock into somehow. And that's not what DOS is. And that was the issue. That's been the issue with DOS for us historically, is that you don't know that you're going to have.
Thanks, Robert. Let's go to Paula next. Hi, Paula.
Hi there. Thanks for having me. This is Paula McGarrigle, Solus Energy Consulting. So where I'm at is investor confidence, the investment community and the finance community seeing DOS as a very significant risk. These assets are minimum 10 years design life. And for something that could be curtailed 7 minutes, 1 hour, and a term that is only 1 year, is likely going to cool any investor with regard to that. That's just insufficient certainty for any investor in energy storage to use the DOS rate. There would need to be some significant changes to this, which had more certainty, both on the timeframe for interruptibility, as well as the term. So right now, I think it's my assessment is there would be limited opportunity for energy storage under the proposed DOS based on investor confidence and financing capabilities. Just like you wouldn't build a wind farm that where your regeneration is going to be interruptible and you set your rates on a 1 year basis, that's difficult. And on the energy storage side, I think it just makes it extraordinarily difficult. So I think we'll need to come back to the table and have a look at this. One of the key things is that nobody has done it under DOS, so obviously people are not using it. But I think for investor confidence, we've got an issue here.
And Paula, help me to understand a little bit. So Steve kind of mentioned this spirit of DOS versus DOS as it's designed right now. We just heard from Rob around the duration as being one of those items. I heard you talk about the duration too. Does the spirit of DOS, do you think, allow enough room for there to be a design in this space? Or is there some non-negotiable factors that we're not seeing or haven't come to light yet?
Where the ISO can choose to curtail you at any moment and there's no limitations on that, is not something that would make the project financeable. You would need to have a limitation on how frequent or how much potential charging loss you would have in a year or in the forecast in order to be able to do a pro forma statement to anticipate what the curtailment would be. But right now, I don't think the ISO could tell us what the curtailment could be, nor would we be able to, and thus rendering a pro forma just not cemented in the facts of what it is. So just from an economics basis, I like the creativity that you guys are bringing to the table, but I don't think this works from a financing point of view. The other question I had is that when you're trying to utilize transmission capacity at best, don't forget that energy storage makes sense when there's a high utilization of the transmission for them to charge at that time, because it's offloading the transmission system at that time, like a demand response. And obviously when there's a low price or possibly a corresponding low use, then BESS would charge, but not necessarily. I think low use of transmission and low price are two different scenarios that we need to contemplate separately. But right now, from a financing point of view, I think we really need to modify the DOS significantly to provide additional certainty to investors that they're not going to be curtailed constantly, rendering the investment just have no rate of return. We need something that's slightly predictable.
Thanks, Paul. Thank you. Let's go to Ed. Or Akira. It looks like Akira is teed up and ready to go.
Hi there, Steve. Hey. Thanks. Or can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh,
yes,
awesome. I actually, you know, I like the general direction of considering DOS as a solution. I do have a question, though. I think we've raised it a couple different times in our stakeholder comments, but there are situations, for instance, when an energy storage asset is providing certain types of products like spinning or regulating reserve, where they could be forced into, because of a system event where, and most system events are under frequency events, but where the system goes to an over frequency event. And in those instances, when other providers, like other traditional generators, provide that service, they can reduce back off the amount of generation. Well, in the case of an energy storage asset, they may have to actually consume off the grid. And so just wondering if you've put into thought how that might be able to be modified, because right now, if that were to occur, you get a 24-month ratchet on your DTS contract, even if you're, you know, with respect to billing capacity. And then, I think that becomes an impediment for those types of resources providing the response in over-frequency events. Now, of course, it's very infrequent, but that was really one of the concerns that we had with respect to the way that the transmission tariff is developed for energy storage and how it precludes you from, or potentially exposes to, a very high cost in providing ancillary services.
Yeah, no, I'll just quickly say we have recognized this and understand that is when providing these services, there is a risk that the service itself forces you into charging. So yeah, that will be, again, factored into our future design in one way or another, whether it's compensated through the, you figure out a way to get that compensated through the market, or it's done within the tariff. But that work has yet to be done.
Thanks for your question, Akira. Ed.
Thank you, Ed DePelzi, DePel Consulting. I agree with the comments that I think the DOS rate could work for storage. And one of the other things that would have to be modernized would be that I think the take or pay provisions. So in the slides, you didn't really cover what the rate sheet shows on DOS, that there is some take or pay charges as well as the megawatt hour charges. And so I think some of those take or pay charges, you know, might make the rate unacceptable. So I think the variable energy charge is a good way to go. And you obviously, you got to have some kind of fixed charge there to recover some application administrative type process, but probably not further than that. As far as the comments on having a term for it, I think that makes a lot of sense. And we need to think about designing this rate, how to study it, and if it's going to be curtailable, and if the storage is really going to be charged in off-peak hours, then maybe that's what needs to be studied and approved. And it seems like if we could make it a long-term rate, then obviously the administration, the ISO goes way down as opposed to some very short interval. So that might be really beneficial to making it a longer-term rate in that way. So I think it's a good start, and it just needs, I think we need a substantial redesign of it. And then I think it can go from a rate that nobody uses to something that's really useful.
Thanks, Ed. Let's go to Jeff Bork.
Hi, Jeff Bork, Alberta Utilities Commission. Has DOS ever been curtailed?
Yes. don't ask me when, but I do know it has been historically.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Jeff. Not seeing any other hands up, so we'll go to the Q&A and see what comes through. Feel free to throw your hand up as well. We do still have some time for this topic. All right. Let's start with Matt Davis's question. Has the ISO evaluated how their tariff proposal will impact the overall DOS rates? Is there an estimate on what they may look like after the proposal be approved?
Do you want to take that one? or that?
So, yeah, Steve had one slide on how the rates are calculated today. And right now, we're not looking at changing how those would be calculated as you move those wires costs to dollars per megawatt hour. So you look at our preferred design has the approximately $10 per megawatt hour energy charge, and look to that for the app product in the DOS. I mean, there's a lot of history in the DOS and DOS rates, but it's still feedback we can receive on how you actually calculate DOS rates.
So if I'm just going to play it back to, sounds like not quite yet. We don't fully understand the impacts or implication of what that would look like.
We're not looking at changing the rate design right now, but you know, we are talking about modernization. Maybe there's something we've missed, so we can hear feedback. But if you can see what the rate would flow out from the preferred design into a DOS rate, it is fairly simple for under the DOS 7-minute design. But.
Matt's got his hand up, so why don't we actually get Matt involved, and then we'll go back to the Q&A.
Hi, thanks for putting me in here, Jordan. I guess, yes, I see what you mean, LaRonda, in terms of how it can quickly flow through. I guess sort of a follow-on question there to some of these comments. With this DOS modernization, are we sort of almost at sort of a blue sky exercise on what DOS could look like in the future? Is that sort of the intent of like the next round? Is that what you're trying to get from market participants right now?
I can hear that kind of color coming across from our presentation, but keeping in mind that those principles of an operating service where it provides value to all ratepayers, and just getting that fine tuning of that fence to get in is of course, an extremely difficult task to do. So it does feel kind of blue sky in / modernization, but the principles will stay the same.
Okay.
My joke backfired. we don't want to re-envision DOS. We think the framework is robust. We want to modernize, honing in on that eligibility question and the transactional components, where I think the pay as bid and the term probably fit into all those, as well as maybe historically you've had to provide megawatt hours estimates of how much DOS you'd use. Maybe there's a shaping component that gets added to capture the consideration that we also heard from Travis.
Spencer, can you turn your camera on for a second?
He's more yellow.
Yeah, so I don't think we're going the blue sky of Nicole and Steve. I think we're going more of the greeny, tawny, yellow skies of Spencer. Here is what I'm hearing. Just a little fun late in the day. Robert.
One question for you guys as we start to consider this is how does this then work through the interconnection process and determining capacity availability if it's under a DOS rate versus the current? Has there been any thought to that, or how would that work?
Are you talking about your DTS contract capacity?
Right, but under a scenario where we've got a modernized DOS.
So someone comes to the ISO and they've got, I don't know, 5 megawatts DTS, and they're looking at some 10 megawatts of DOS. How will we work that in our connection process to study to make sure there's enough capacity or the right kind of capacity?
Right. So if I'm coming to you with 2 megawatts of DTS and 100 megawatts of DOS. Or 200 megawatts of DOS, right?
Maybe we're not there yet, but good point.
That's the scale of assets that we're talking about. Right?
And so the standard connection process would apply for the 2 megawatts, and a separate evaluation process of is the 100 megawatts available. I think that's a separate, not part of the connection process, but a DOS evaluation process, which as an opportunity service can be curtailed in real time, but then also in that longer term time period, there may, this kind of gets to that 1 year term. How frequently would we be needing to assess the 100 megawatts to, I guess to some degree, understand the constraints for the party on DOS, because the ISO would have the control to curtail that 100 megawatts whenever the constraints were to occur. Okay. Did that help?
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Robert. I want to get to Raj's question in the Q&A, and then Curtis really quickly, and then we'll probably close out on Paula's question with her hand up. So Raj's question in the Q&A, Steve, can you please explain how the criterion the DOS must meet a temporary economic opportunity is applied in practice? Can you help us to understand that?
How it is applied today, I guess, is the question.
I would assume that's probably more within the context of today, but it's probably got a bit of a, and therefore, how do we envision it might happen in the future element to it? So maybe if you could straddle both sides of that time horizon. Just while I'm asking you to do mental gymnastics. But.
Yeah, and I'm not sure I can give a great answer at this point, other than that it is a very case by case, and it's based on your application to the ISO. And we, again, today we would assess that application and then determine on a number of factors, whether it meets the criteria of it being a market opportunity, or if it's for the purpose of term DOS and taking an outage. So again, depending on the what is submitted in the application for DOS, determines whether you are get eligibility for it. And then the actual use of DOS comes through the submission of the transaction request. Well, you do that in advance attempting to use that energy.
Okay.
And that's the current state, the future state. I mean, there'll still be an eligibility requirement. We still want to make sure that this is a rate that is only used for capacity that would not other occur that would not otherwise occur under DTS.
I think that's probably good, Steve.
Yeah.
Okay. Curtis's question before we go to Paula, is the ISO looking at linking the energy charge from the bulk and regional tariff design discussed most of the morning to the energy charge components of the new modern DOS rate? Might be a little bit tough to answer in that future state world right now, but is that part of the conversations that have taken place to date?
I think that was part of the answer to Matt as well, not looking at redividing the rate calculation. So very similar to what it is today.
Brilliant. We will close that one off. It looks like Curtis has a follow-up to it. So we'll get to Paula, and then we'll get to Curtis, and then we'll move on to implementation considerations. So Paula, why don't you come join us?
Thank you very much. Again, Paula with Solus Energy. What happens in the future when additional load connects to that transmission line? Is the DOS reduced, that is what is available, or does the DOS service provide any protection to the installed energy storage that's already there? If in the future there's additional load and there's less room on that transmission line, is there any protection to the energy storage that was installed in year one when in year five there's additional load and not enough room?
As an opportunity service, it's only able to be used if it's available. And so that if there's a load that's added under a DTS contract, they've
paid
that firm service. So they are
providing. So that again comes down to the financeability of the projects. as a result, is that if you can be knocked off because of what's happening for load in the region, then this is a concern.
Well, there is the DTS rate service available where you can get firm service,
which is on economic on the energy storage side. Yeah. Okay. So I think if we're to use DOS, those key aspects around project financing needs to be taken care of.
Okay. Thanks, Paula. Curtis.
Good afternoon. This is Curtis Glazier with Heartland Generation. So as a follow-up to my question, if there isn't necessarily a discussed linkage between what we talked about this morning and the rate design that we're discussing with energy storage, is the ISO contemplating a parallel process where we could discuss an energy storage rate or other opportunity service rates in a separate forum than the bulk and transmission rate design tariff?
I'm not certain that I understand your question, Curtis. Do you think you could take a second run at that for me to help me understand?
Yeah. So currently we're discussing both energy storage rate as part of the larger tariff design consultation. Is the ISO looking at perhaps divorcing these in the future if there isn't that linkage that my question alluded to? That if we want to talk about opportunity service or other rates, it might be easier to do so in a more targeted consultation.
I understand your question. Nicole, do you think you want to take that one?
Sure. And we've been focused on keeping energy storage treatment within the Balkan regional tariff design conversation because we from that tariff design perspective of it's not about what technology is using the grid, it's about the inflows and outflows on the grid and how charges should be set up based on how that those inflows and outflows may cause costs. And so we've been very focused of keeping energy storage, we're very focused on keeping that in this overall Balkan regional conversation. Now where we've landed is no specific energy storage tariff treatment. We've landed with the preferred rate design that we have here and what we're identifying is an opportunity and not just for energy storage, but for potentially energy storage and then other loads that are that aren't currently under a DTS, but potentially extract some further opportunity from using the demand opportunity service that there's some value to explore making or modernizing this rate. I'm getting a long-winded way here. Question. So we've been focused on keeping energy storage part of this bigger discussion. Now that we've landed the preferred design, I think you're saying, well, do we really need to keep this DOS conversation here or can it be separated off? I think because it's really focused, there's that tight component of making sure that the demand opportunity service doesn't lead to any reductions in DTS because that would be a cost risk for consumers. I think there's some desire to keep it tight, but maybe something for us to consider as we move forward here.
Yeah, I would just advise that possibly if we're looking at changing the opportunity service rate, we might want to do that regardless of what the final rate design is. So by separating the two, we actually are able to have two distinct conversations that are linked rather than one causally linked discussion.
Put another way, Curtis, you don't think that energy storage in Balkan Regional should be one conversation? You think that they should be two?
I mean, I think we might want to explore the opportunity service regardless of what the final rate design ends up being.
Okay. I'm going to choose to hear the answer that I characterize and summarize too, but I hear it. Yeah. Let's go then to Horst and Suncor, and then we're going to move on to implementation considerations. Go ahead, Horst.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. You're good. A little quiet, so make sure you speak up. But
yeah, I had to switch computers here, so that's why I'm not sure if it works well. But there was a comment that I think Steve or Nicole just made, which kind of raised the question, and that was that we don't want people to sign up for DOS if they would otherwise sign up for DTS. And I think that sounds like a bit of a narrow-minded perspective, because let's say it is economic for me to sign up for RAID DTS, but I really do not need the service that is included in RAID DTS. That's way too gold-plated for what I ever need, but I can't afford it, so I would sign up for it. But I don't need it, and I don't need the system to be built to give me 24/7 service at full capacity capability. It's really not something I need. So just because it's economic to use RAID DTS doesn't mean that it is desirable from a grid perspective or from a societal perspective for me to sign up for RAID DTS. Maybe DOS is not the right version, but I think a perspective that have multiple service levels and let people choose the one they need and pay for the service they receive should be the framework, and not, well, let's make sure that everybody, to the extent possible, signs up for RAID DTS, and then we'll have some exceptions, because RAID DTS is really the gold-plated service.
Thanks, Horst. Steve, Nicole, I don't know if there's a response there or a clarification or just good input from Horst.
Appreciate the comment.
Yeah. Thanks, Horst. All right, it is 3:35. We are going to move into implementation considerations, which is our kind of final topic before we move towards kind of close up for the day. Appreciate everyone's continued engagement and focus and concentration for it. So I think this is, who do we have teed up? Hi, LaRonda. Welcome, LaRonda, to the conversation, please.
I have two slides, and I'm going to watch those participants' numbers and see if it drops below 90 here. So give me two slides worth, and then there's some good information about next steps. But as much as important the conversation we've had all day today, these are also fairly important, and this is kind of looking forward to what could happen over the next few months, the amount of additional analysis that we still need to do and get out to stakeholders on what you may expect, and then a few more questions we have for you and to get feedback on. So our first point is that as we provided you the 2019 test year rates, we will eventually get to final rates that would be put into place upon a commission approval of a design. That would come fairly late in the game, as we would need to know the revenue requirement based on TFO approved rates and et cetera, and billing determinants for that year. But looking towards the filing, we've already got some requests, and I think it's a good point to get out that bill impact data information to the best of our ability so that people can get a full picture of the impact of design. So that's something we're going to look at, see when, how we could do that, along with rate calculations. Again, this will always be sort of the test rate view until we would actually get to a commission approval, okay, rates go into effect. That's kind of what the first bullet's kind of about. We also wanted to give you a little heads up on red tape reduction in our rate sheets. And here, there's red tape reduction, but in the end, we want to see rate sheets that may be a lot easier for other people to understand, to see what is my rate DTS, how is it calculated? There's some improvements that we can achieve through red tape reduction, making the sheets maybe a little bit more user-friendly. So you can expect to see that as we get closer to filing. As part of the cost causation models that Spencer and Richard presented to us today, we're proposing to update those calculations every 5 years. In the past, it's been a transmission cost causation study approved on a 3-year go forward basis. We haven't quite met 3 years. We think 5 years is a good balance of accuracy and precision, regulatory efficiency and simplicity, and certainty on rates. The other part here where we would like some feedback is We're looking to change currently the highest coincident meter demand in the month is determined based off of the highest 15-minute interval, moving that to the hourly interval. This aligns with the cost causation principles, as the hourly data is what's used in our planning, our transmission planning, and our forecasts. We feel there's a lot more information out there for stakeholders on an hourly basis to help them understand how load changes. And it's more transparent. And like I said, it aligns more with our public information. On slide 80, some more feedback we're looking on. Sort of our principals had talking about flexibility. And so we want to hear back from stakeholders on their thoughts on a couple items. And one of them, contract capacity, as we move to a new tariff design, would participants be looking for a contract reset period? And this could allow participants to reset their contract megawatts without a pylon payment. And just it really is a reset. I think of that in context with our next bullet point there on expanding pylon waiver provisions. Some of the feedback we've got over the last little while is the pylon or the payment of in lieu of notice may be giving us contrary information. The pylon is intended to provide good information, the financial signal for customers to give us really good information on their contract capacity. But what we're finding is a lot of customers are forced to make that decision of paying that pylon, and maybe with their operations at their site may end up hitting a new peak and your pylon is sort of a waste of dollar. And what we're finding then is we're not getting that good information about how a customer is intending to operate their site. So we're looking to get more accurate information by sending the signal that if you haven't made a change to your DTS in the past 5 years, that a pylon would not be applicable. In some of this, the weight of this pylon goes down a little bit in our preferred design as the billing capacity charge has been reduced. But it's still really good to hear from stakeholders to see what their thoughts are and how this might impact them and the decisions they make at their site. So that was a little two slides of a whole lot of information from A to Z. I am Canadian, Zed. So I'll just hand it over to next steps unless there's any questions about all of that.
There is a couple questions, so we'll take a minute or two for it. Let's start with Raj Sharma. Go ahead, Raj. Raj, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Now we can, yes. Yeah.
Okay. So my question is on moving from 15 minutes to hourly. So what I've been seeing is a lot of jurisdictions moving to 10 minutes or 5 minutes to better integrate wind and solar and storage. And seems like we are going in a different direction. I would have thought the ISO operations and then planning would want to go to a more granular interval, not in the other direction. So has there been a study or a discussion or a sense of that we wouldn't have to switch back to something like 10 minutes or 5 minutes in the future?
Well, for moving to 1 hour, it does align with our current processes. So what you're saying is if in the future we went to a shorter, settlement period, would it all shift back? I think what we're really looking for is consistency. And it's not a big cost change to be consistent today in the new tariff. And then everything could be aligned. I think there's a lot of value in that. I don't know what the future holds about moving to shorter settlement periods, but at least we'd have that consistency.
Okay. Thanks, Laronda. Thanks for your question, Raj. Let's go to Surendra.
Thanks, Jordan. Laronda, I believe that excuse me, the billing capacity is also based on 15 minute, right?
Well, highest meter demand and contract capacity and ratchet.
So the highest meter demand that the that based on hourly or 15 minute?
Hourly.
Hourly? Okay, I thought it was 15 minute. Okay, so that's what you are making all of these are to hourly, right?
Right.
Okay, okay, I got it. Thank you.
Thanks, Surendra. Jeff.
Hi, Laranda. Jeff Bork with AEC. You had mentioned that there is a lot of hourly information available, but there is a question that I have, and it regards system demand. So if the coincident peak is based on system demand, it seems like, but for the grace of others, system demand isn't a normal report that can be pulled up on ETS. Like the only way I've been able to find system demand is through the data request page that's on the market webpage, or a summary of when the actual coincident peak events were that's on the operating reserves page. Does the AESO have any plans of making that data more conveniently available as opposed to, again, but for the grace of others having asked for when is the system demand and in that regard, so that we can make these better distinctions between Alberta internal load and system demand?
Just let me take that away, Jeff, because there's two things. When people ask for more detail on the system peak, they want early notice of when it was, or to show that how it was that hour and how it wasn't a different hour. Which kind of information do you think people would be looking for?
Well, I think so. Like if I'm looking and trying to say, I just want to see a graph of when the system demand is on, let's say, an hourly basis. I'm looking on the data requests page right now, and I see a data request for July 13th, 2020. And that was the only way that I was able to find getting access to system load data, even on an hourly basis. And then I would have to look at that and say, okay, go and compare it with the operational reserves, the summary of when the coincident peaks were, to then say, oh yeah, it looks like that should have been the hour. But again, I would need 15 minute granular data to be able to confirm that. But no, it's just a question of, okay, so if the AESO does move to hourly data, where is that more publicly available than just AIL? So that way one could take that and create trends based on it and do their own ad hoc analyses on their own computer, but for paying the AESO or making formal data requests.
Right, and it's been a while, but I the meter volumes report that you can get is a little closer to actual system demand. It's meter value rather than some SCADA calculated value. We also were working on an hourly tool to help provide that information. I'm sorry, I just can't find it right now, but I'll take away the point that we agree that the data should, if it's a pricing signal meant to inform customers and how to adjust their load, there needs to be good data out there to help them understand. So I take that point.
Okay. Thanks, Laranda. Thanks for your question, Jeff. Colette.
Hi, it's Colette Chikurta again with the ADC. I just wanted to provide our feedback on the waiving of the pylon or allowing customers to change their DTS contract capacity. And I think we would wholeheartedly agree that this should be implemented and not even waited for the tariff. This is something, and I can just share my observations of some of the sites that I've just been working through in response to this tariff change. There's many out there that are billing on contract capacities that they may not even realize the impact of this cost increase to their sites because of the fact that they hadn't optimized their contracts today. So I think through this process, you should also be identifying those who are billing on contract capacities and letting them know and trying to get these right-sized as soon as possible.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Colette. All right, any other hands going up? Also see another question. Matt's more providing an opportunity for Jeff to maybe understand some of the information that he needs, so I'm not going to cover that right now, but I'll let you guys connect offline on that. Not seeing any other questions or hands raised up So we're going to move into next steps. Spencer.
Awesome. Thanks, Jordan. On the next slide, 82, we'll go through a little bit more detail around the upcoming dates we have. So March 31st, next week, we hope to see you again here to talk about the Bill Impact tool and get your questions about how to apply that to your specific situation and understand what it's telling you. After that, basically up until May is our targeted engagement for customers that are expected to experience that transmission cost impact of 10% or more. Following the Bill Impact session, so the March 31st session, we're going to have a two-week period to have one-on-one meetings with folks that have questions about the Bill Impact tool that, you know, maybe you don't feel comfortable asking in front of a larger group just because we know that data is sensitive. And so we're inviting you to have that kind of one-on-one discussion. April 15th, we're looking to get your feedback from all of what we've presented today, as well as that Bill Impact analysis. And then we'll be coming back, and we have late May, early June as our target for session 6, where we'll talk about all the work that we've done in the intervening time. That includes the results or the outcomes of the discussions we've had around that targeted mitigation, the further information about energy storage, as well as the, you know, the feedback and the follow-up from what we've heard today. And that puts us in good shape to file the application with the AUC in June of this year. On slide 83, we, you know, just really want to thank you for your participation today, for your engagement throughout this. You know, we do really benefit from the conversation and the dialogue that we're able to have, as well as the feedback that you provide as a follow-up. We are going to launch a poll, so Carla, go ahead and launch that. We do want to collect some initial feedback just on the session we had today and get some initial impressions from you. And I think if we can go to slide 84, while we have that open, this just gives you a little bit more information about the areas where we would like your feedback, as well as how you can find the comment matrix. So that's you know, within the Balkan Regional Engagement page for session 5. You can find that document there. And we're looking for feedback on a number of specifics, as well as some overall questions. So you'll find those in that document. I think we can go to slide 85 and talk a little bit about some further details around session 6. Don't need to get into a lot of the details, but we will tell you when it's happening with enough advance notice so that you're able to register. We haven't set the date yet, but we do have that late May, early June target in mind. The purpose, you know, we're going to discuss kind of what we heard today, the outcomes of where we got to with the targeted engagement on mitigation, as well as that energy storage treatment. And we have a bunch of objectives that we're hoping to achieve with you then. So once again, on behalf of everyone here on the ISO side, thank you for your participation today. I know I've learned a lot and gained a lot from the discussion. And yeah, really appreciate your really good questions and comments that we've heard throughout the day. So thanks very much.
Thanks all.